If you recall, I started last week's show with the question, do you agree with me that Americans know far too little about the world? Well, we're at it again this week. Last week's guest was Samantha Power, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and until a few days ago, a foreign policy advisor to Barack Obama. As many of you may have heard, she resigned from his campaign late last week after calling Hillary Clinton a, quote, monster who would try anything to get elected in an interview in Scotland. And I'm sorry she said that and sorry she had to resign. I'm also sorry Clinton ran her 3 a.m. television ad playing the fear card, questioning Obama's readiness, and elsewhere stating, and I'm not making this a quote, but that she and McCain would both be better equipped than her Democratic rival to handle national security issues. Finally, I'm sorry Power didn't blurt her forbidden word out during our interview. The publicity would have been great for KPFK. But now to this week's show. Looking beyond U.S. borders, this is a rare moment. Sure, we're in a war and there's terrorism and so on, but not one of the world's powers is an enemy. The threats to our security do not come from rival nation states. With some threats, like climate change, as Walt Kelly put it via Pogo, the enemy is us. And even the greatest external violent threats have roots not in powerful nations, but in instability, in states at risk of failure. Our ability to solve all major global problems is compromised or made impossible by things like tribal conflicts, the failure of national institutions, and the resulting breakdown of authority and accountability. Now, some may say, you know, but yeah, but there's other causes. Yes, there are. But still, the breakdown of states, which leads to the breakdown of accountability, is a big player in disease, climate change, terrorism, etc. A new book, The Next American Century, How the U.S. Can Thrive as Other Powers Rise, argues that it is good for us that other pivotal nations grow wealthier and stronger. Not bad for us, not a problem for us, but actually to our benefit. We need them on our side so that together we can solve the global problems of peace, climate, health, and justice. And one of its authors, Nina Hajikian, is with me in the studio today. Nina Hajikian is a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress and a part of their small team out here in Los Angeles. She's also a visiting scholar at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford. Earlier, she was the director of the Center for Asia-Pacific Policy and a senior political scientist at RAND in Santa Monica. And from 98 to 99, she was on the staff of the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. Welcome, Nina Hajikian.
I'm delighted to be here, Terrence. Thank you.
Now, first, briefly, I always like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas in the work. And you opened the book with the line, quote, our political coming of age, this is you and Mona Sutphin, your co-author, our political coming of age was marked by the fall of the Berlin Wall, not by the Vietnam War. Now, could you go a little bit beyond that and talk a little about what the world looked like, perhaps even as you were growing up, before you were a political scientist, an expert, a pundit, an advisor, just some of your evolving view of the U.S. in the world?
Well, I was, my parents are both immigrants. My mother is first generation. She was born in Germany, and my father's parents were born in Armenia. So from a young age, I think I had an awareness of the fact that there was a big world out there, and we traveled frequently to Europe in particular to see relatives. So that part of it was always there for me. And I do remember growing up, I'm thinking now about the day after that, the TV show. And so there was an awareness of nuclear Armageddon, that I had. But as, you know, as you just read, by the time I was in my 20s, that was all behind us and very suddenly behind us. And then the challenge became, okay, now we have a very new landscape. How do we deal with it?
Mm-hmm. So in other words, what you're saying is it wasn't like a radical change because the Berlin Wall, how old were you?
Let's see. So I was born in 67, and that was
22.
Yeah.
So the Cold War is basically over as you're graduating from college.
Exactly right.
Okay. And I must say, I'm graduated college in 1969, in the thick of the Vietnam War. I mean, we are, you know, sort of
right.
on those. And I think, by the way, I think you and Mona probably know this and acknowledge this, but it does seem that there's something in some ways generational. And then I look at, you know, the current political presidential race with McCain, Clinton, and Obama, and I see perhaps some of the same generational strains. We'll maybe look at that a little later in the conversation. But you say we're at a, as I quoted, a unique moment in our history when no major powers are enemy. Now, it seems to me we've been at this moment for at least a number of years, right?
Yeah.
And how would you describe our response so far, and how do you explain it?
Well, when the Soviet Union collapsed, we were left as the only superpower. But we have been sort of conditioned because of the rise of Germany and then World War II and then the rise of the Soviet Union and the Cold War to see the rise of other strong nations as a potential threat to us. And you saw that playing out in the late 80s and 90s with Japan. And then, you know, lots of fear about Japan and Japan's economy, even though Japan is a military ally, small country, a democracy, and yet we still got very, you know, wound up about
I know
it.
If we look back at that now and could run some of the either the journalism or the TV coverage and so on of the
right.
I remember Fallow's book, you know, the sun, the rising sun, and so on.
We have actually a chart that I think is very funny in the book where we compare the titles of publications that came out around that time as to Japan to titles that are coming out now as to China, and the words are almost identical.
Sure.
You know, hegemon and you know take us over, etc. So but the fact is that today, to get to the major point, none of these powers are our enemies, and we think it's not even most constructive to think of them as rivals. I mean, they are in certain areas. We have great disagreements. There are still flashpoints, like issues like Taiwan, where we have real serious disagreements. But if you look at the real issues that Americans care about, the safety at home and prosperity and even and the promotion of democracy, these countries are not our enemies. They are, in fact, our partners. And if we want to be able to keep Americans safe at home, we have to work with them.
Mm-hmm. And were you... I've listened to a couple of other interviews as well as reading the book, but there's a point that you make, which is that there had been sort of this knee-jerk reaction, shall we say, to China, or I guess China, India kind of was the big perceived threat. And you say that when you set out to write this book, you didn't necessarily have your conclusion. You had questions. Let me ask you, what were those questions, and were you surprised by what you learned?
Yes, we were surprised. But so we, you know, we started writing this book, I think it was in 2000. We had the idea in 2005 and began writing it then, and in 2006 and 7. At that time, there was a lot of, and there is still today, a lot of headlines about China's military advances and taking jobs and jobs moving, you know, outsourcing to India. And so we thought, you know, we know that the Cold War route doesn't make sense because we live in a different world now. And it just, you know, with countries that we're trading with so much and whose rise benefits us in so many ways, the Cold War route doesn't make sense. But what does make sense? And where are the issues where we actually ought to be oppositional, where there really is a conflict, and where are the issues where there is not a conflict? And so that's the set of questions we were trying to address. And so we were expecting to find a very kind of mixed bag that, you know, yes, their rise is beneficial in some ways, but it really harms us, you know, deeply in other ways. And what we found is that really there are not many issues of consequence where we are really at odds with them, that there are some of those, but for the most part, the answers lie in America's own strength at home. And that was another kind of surprising conclusion of the book, that a lot of our domestic policies are, you know, getting those right is what's going to enable us to thrive. Not what, you know, not what China does, not what Russia does, not what India does, but what we do here at home.
How so? What are some of the keys to that piece?
Let's look, for example, at innovation. So there are a lot of fear that more and more innovation is happening in China and Russia and India, and that is the case.
And Brazil, for that matter.
Yeah. So a lot more innovation is happening elsewhere. But that is really fine for Americans. We ought to, in fact, welcome that, because as Americans, we will benefit if an Indian company comes up with a cure for Alzheimer's or for cancer. We should celebrate that. There'll be certain, you know, American companies that lose profits until they start to compete at this, you know, but basically it's a good thing for Americans. But the key is we have to keep our innovation system strong here at home, because we have been able to import talent to make up for the difference. But a lot of Chinese and Indian and Russian scientists are staying now in their countries exactly for the, because there is more and more going on. There are more opportunities
and
for them.
That's been exacerbated by our immigration policies as well, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
Since 9/11.
Absolutely right. It's getting harder and harder to import talent. But the fact is we have to invest in our own kids, and they are not prepared to step into the breach here. There's a study that this group called the OECD does every few years, and the most recent results showed that American teenagers are in this really dubious category of both being less talented than their peers around the world in terms of math and science, but more confident than their peers in terms of their abilities. We're good at being confident, I guess. But the importance, you know, the thing is that it's fine for that innovation to happen elsewhere as long as it continues to happen here. So investing in education, that's one really important thing. The second is, you know, we worry about jobs being outsourced, and they are. It's actually a very small number, only something like 2% of the 15 million jobs that are lost every year, and this year I'm sure it'll be more, are due to trade. And the rest are mostly due to technology displacement. So it's a small number, but...
Now, let me just go over those numbers again. So you're saying 15 million jobs are lost every year?
Right. In our economy. And the same number created, more or less.
So if we're at balance, we still lose 15 million, but we create 15 million more.
Right.
And you're saying that of that 15 million, 2 million are lost because of trade. Now...
2% of 15.
Oh, only 2%?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a small number.
Very small. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the fact is that's, you know, deeply painful for those people. And right now, you know, I think we're leaving our workers kind of high and dry. I mean, it's true that trade benefits our overall economy, but it's our workers that are feeling the brunt of that. But there's lots we can do for our workers that we haven't done. We could have a program like wage insurance so that if they lose a job and then get a new job that pays less, you know, the insurance makes up the difference. Universal health care would relieve some of the anxiety for folks who've lost their job and then now are worried that they can't take their kid to the doctor. Universal health care, by the way, would also encourage some businesses that are likely to put jobs overseas because our health care is so expensive.
Well, as we've pointed out in the show many times, what I hear is that the biggest financial piece of a car rolling off an assembly line in Detroit is healthcare and benefits, or maybe just healthcare benefits. And so obviously the competition in Japan, who has universal healthcare, doesn't have, I mean, they start out, you know, ahead of us when they start building the car.
Yeah, no, exactly right. So that's just another example of how, you know, it's our domestic agenda at home, which is going to enable us to thrive abroad.
Okay. I was thinking as you were answering that I would leave this for the end, but sometimes I never get to that question that I leave at the end. So I'm going to ask you now, why is it so hard? And I'm saying, you know, as you were writing this book, you had to ask yourself this question. Why is it so hard for Americans to see what you just said and feel like investing in education and training and universal health care is worth more than fighting any damn war?
You know, I'm not sure it's Americans. I think it might be Washington. In terms of we found some really interesting stuff that if you poll Americans, poll after poll, year after year, Mona and I found that Americans are actually very kind of multilaterally oriented. They want to work with the rest of the world. They don't want to disengage and they don't want to preach and dictate. But if you look at the opinions of staffers in Congress, they're very different. And what's really interesting is if you ask staffers, what do Americans think? They always get it wrong. Something like, you know, 92% of staffers will say that Americans don't really want to work through the UN, even if that means that, you know, it's going to cost America a little more. Whereas Americans do want that. And staffers and people in the Beltway, they don't understand what Americans actually feel.
And yet they get elected.
And yet they get elected.
So you had to ask yourself that question. I wrote down redistricting. Is that now that all congressional representatives are elected in safe districts, they're only appealing to the base, and you can win being appealing to the base even if the mass of people have much more enlightened opinions.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. And also, you know, Americans don't tend to vote on foreign policy. I'm hoping that as we go forward and Americans...
But wait a minute. Wait a minute. What we're saying is Americans think that education and healthcare is more important than foreign policy. So the fact that they don't vote on foreign policy should
be a good thing, yeah, in a way.
You shouldn't be able to say the staffers get it wrong and that people don't. But go ahead.
Well. The point being that if people don't vote based on what their congressperson does in the UN, for example. So that's that.
So what you're saying is the congressperson can get away
exactly
with being wrong on foreign policy because when it finally comes down to it, they vote on domestic policy. So the fact that that guy in Congress or his staffers don't know how important that is to people ends up not mattering? Ugh.
Yeah.
this is getting worse.
That is the bottom line. But I'm actually kind of encouraged about this election because for the first time, universal health care is really on the agenda. I mean, both on...
That's right. The question sort of is how universal is yours versus mine?
Exactly. And that, you know, we've come a long way. All the candidates are talking about climate change, which is, you know, a whole other, you know, discussion we can have. So I feel like we are making some progress. You know, I don't know why we haven't been able to make the investments in education that we really should. And I think it has to do with, you know, local control versus national control and all that. But God, we really have to get that right if we're going to be able to do better.
My guess is, although you tell me that the public feels it, my guess is that they're not informed enough. I don't know if people say this, but certainly whenever commentators or politicians say, if they're talking about healthcare, they'll say, well, we have the greatest healthcare in the world as an accepted notion, but we've got some problems. When the fact is we do not have the greatest healthcare in the world. And they will probably say, we have the greatest education system in the world, but we have some problems. And we're ranked 20th, 30th out of, you know, developed countries. My guess is that people actually don't know how bad it is. How many more engineers China and India graduate each year these days than we do? If you can reel them off, what are the biggest threats facing the U.S.?
The two that can actually kill large numbers of Americans, you know,
quickly,
today, or hopefully, you know, whatever, in the next year or so, would be a terrorist attack, especially with some sort of nuclear device, and disease, and a very contagious flu-like epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, down from that, there are, you know, the nuclear proliferation to states, to hostile states like North Korea and Iran, climate change,
So with Iran and North Korea, maybe not so likely to happen. There's lots of ways to stop it before it happens, et cetera. There's reasons even they won't do it.
Exactly.
With climate change, the really drastic effects are long term. So, but let's say that those are even the four biggest threats. One thing I didn't see that much of is the economic crisis. Now, I wonder if you were writing the book today, if you'd be talking about that more.
Yeah, I mean, we do have a whole chapter on economics, but right, I mean, at the time, our economy was, you know, perhaps, I mean, our economy was not treating everybody equally, and there was a lot of stagnation in the middle class and the lower class, but basically, it was growing, and now, you know, we're in a very different situation.
And the other thing that I assume was true, as you were writing the book, you said 05 to 08, right, was the incredible indebtedness that we have to China, to Taiwan, to Japan, et cetera, to the UK, and the fact that we do not save as a people or as a government, and that we depend on this system that they need us to stay financially viable because we buy their products, so they won't call our bluff or they won't pull their funds. Is that a threat? And is that one where your analysis, you know, where a China does have enormous leverage?
They do have leverage, but it's not at all in their interest to have our dollar devalue because they own huge numbers of treasury. So if our dollar devalues, then, you know, they lose out. So they do have leverage in
a way.
So
we're in this together.
We really are.
We're like a codependent relationship. We enable them.
Exactly.
And they enable
us. Exactly,
yes.
Right.
Okay. And what we enable in their case is bad labor practices, bad environmental practices, and what they enable in us is that we don't know how to save a dollar to save our souls.
Exactly.
Let me ask about, and so you say, two biggest threats, terrorism, pandemic, and then you go on to the other. Now, aside from the fluky one, the hostile nation, most of them, it seems to me, apply to the what I said in the introduction, that the real fear is in failed states, is in states failing and so on. Thomas P. M. Barnett, right? You're familiar with his work, and he talks about the same thing, that there's a functioning core, then there's a non-integrating gap, and those are those failed states. And he feels that that's where the trouble comes, and he has a, do you agree with that sense?
I certainly agree that failed states are a source of great instability.
Let me say one other thing I wanted to mention, by the way. I don't know if you're aware of Lester Brown's work. Lester Brown, you know, started World Watch. His newest Plan B 3.0, unlike 2.0 and 1.0, his Plan B, which is how we're going to save civilization, has started as an environmental work. His newest version really says that failed states are a crucial piece of this, that as a certain number of states fail, our ability to solve global problems may fail.
I agree with that. I agree that failed states are a real source of instability. And the good news, though, from the book is that all these big powers share that threat. And so they are very invested in trying to counter terrorism and trying to shore up failing states. They don't want instability. We basically all want the same things. We want stability. We want open trade. And that counts for Russia, for China, for India, for Europe, for Japan. We all want those same goals. And that, so that if we can work together, even if we don't like each other, if we can work together toward fighting terrorism and preventing the huge destruction of climate change and fighting together in terms of trying to combat pandemic disease and identifying the pathogens, et cetera, then, you know, we have a chance of actually...
Is there something, and let me just go through those states again so people know. We said them a couple of times, but this is really what your book is about, is our relationship to what you call the pivotal powers.
That's
you
right.
call Europe one,
right.
rather than Germany, France. It's Europe, China, India, Russia...
Japan.
And Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. Okay, so that's... Is there something, I didn't hear in that answer, something that those powers can do together to make it less likely that states fail?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, we're working with them on a daily basis in terms of trying to counter specific terrorist plots and terrorist threats.
Whereas what I see is terrorism is a symptom of a failed state, or without a failed state, you are unlikely to have a home. For, you know, well, I guess that's not true since we know that terrorism now shows up in London.
Right,
so on.
Right. I mean, yeah, and the 9/11 yeah. hijackers are from Hamburg. So,
right.
I mean, I think failed states are where terrorists are likely to reside. I mean, we see that in Afghanistan when the Taliban was there. I mean, that was
right. border. That's not where they get their checks.
Right, but that's where they set up shop.
Yeah,
right.
That's where they can train and run
but Afghanistan
free.
Is a good example. When we went into Afghanistan, all these pivotal powers helped us and wanted to help us in terms of
and
taking out Al-Qaeda.
Had we stayed the course, if
yeah.
you will, in
yes.
that country instead of shifting, you think that would have stayed with us, the international effort, and we would have all been on that one?
Absolutely. I mean, NATO, for the first time in its history, invoked this clause that, you know, when one is attacked, we are all attacked. I mean, everyone was ready to help us, and... I think for a variety of reasons, we didn't necessarily always take them up on their help as much as we could have. But, you know, putting that aside, we really squandered that goodwill, obviously, when we went into Iraq. But it's just be interesting for your listeners. I just want to talk a little bit about the terrorism piece because, for example, India has been tracking Islamic extremist groups.
This was a surprise to me.
Yeah, for decades, right? Because they used to target just India, and they're just concerned about this disputed region of Kashmir. And now they're going after us. But we don't know anything about them. These groups like LET and JEM that have been attacking for India all this time, we now need to really work with the Indians in order to figure out who these people are, what they want.
But as you point out, Indian intelligence on that group, the LET,
mm-hmm.
Which they've been tracking for Kashmir problems, they actually worked with us to foil a plot and got some convictions. And you say that is the most convictions on terrorism charges that has happened since 9/11.
That's right. I mean, I actually don't know. It would be classified to the extent to which India worked with us on that particular case, but they are working with us on a regular basis in terms of tracking down these groups and informing us about what they want, et cetera. And China allows our inspectors in their ports to screen shipping containers for smuggled nuclear material. So that's pretty important.
Now,
there's 3 million of those.
We do as much searching before as we do when they arrive.
Right. Well, I think we're just starting to search when they arrive, and but you know, it's ideal to search before they leave for our shores, and there are 3 million that leave every year, or more than that. So that's a pretty important form of cooperation that we've got going on with China.
And just, you've only got a few, like 15 seconds, an example of Russia.
Where they are co-leading with us a group of 50 nations trying to keep nuclear material out of the hands of terrorists. That is a joint U.S.-Russian effort that you don't hear much about.
And whatever else has gone on with Putin's, restoring autocratic rule and all of that, that has not flagged.
That's right. That's right.
And the only lack really is whether we fund it. Or how much we fund it?
Right. I mean, we don't fund enough, I think, the kind of securing of loose nuclear material in Russia.
Okay. And do you see, this is going to be real quick, this is almost like a yes-no, any of the presidential candidates more in tune than others with what you're saying?
Yeah, I think Obama and Clinton are both pretty in tune with what we're saying.
Okay. The book is The Next American Century. The website is nextamericancentury.com. And thank you, Nina Hachikian. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence.